So Scott, you said this is based on a real flight, and I think that people are probably going to be wondering, how did the meteorologist get himself into this in the first place?
Yeah, Ryan, it was an interesting flight. I was basically coming back from this trip, and my my goal was to try to get home, as just like everybody else wants to. And the thought was we would make a westerly route around the west side of D.C. and stay away from Philadelphia and avoid the primary weather issue that was occurring. But this was less of a weather issue, more of an air traffic control issue, because we were told from the very beginning that there was no way that they were going to give us out of Lincoln Park, New Jersey, a westerly route, because it would interfere with all the arrivals and departures out of New York. So, the goal was to get in the air and start negotiating if possible, but just due to unforeseen circumstances, we just ended up getting on the east side of D.C. anyway, so we just pushed forward. Not the best choice, but ultimately that's what it ended up happening.
And you were not the PIC on this flight, right? You were, so maybe, did you maybe not do your full weather analysis of that system beforehand, and that's why it took stopping to figure it out?
Yeah, that's the issue, is that when I looked at the weather in the morning, I'm a well-informed passenger in this flight. Being an instructor, I wasn't putting my instructor hat on. I was just a passenger. But ultimately, came down to the simple fact is I'd never really looked at it, because I never thought we would be entering that part of the airspace to do it. So it really didn't appear to me, although I did glance at it, didn't appear to me as something I needed to kind of drill down on and see what was going on there. So yeah, it's part of it is that it wasn't until we got to the Richmond area that I threw my instructor hat on and said, it's time to put this thing down and figure it out.
Yeah. So in a situation, this is for the whole table, a situation where ATC is rejecting your route here and you really want to go west, does anybody have any tricks for getting the route that they originally wanted? Tom?
Oh, yeah, I don't know if it's going to work every time, but I mean, I don't know how persistent your pilot was in this case, Scott, about asking for something more westerly. But I've been known to be very persistent with ATC, and particularly when I'm looking at weather, as much rain and turbulence as was ahead, based on what we knew from our pre-flight briefing and maybe what I was hearing on the frequency others reporting. I've been known to be very persistent with ATC and really hounding them for a turn to the west and letting them know that the reason that I'm asking for it is because I'm concerned about the weather and the turbulence or rain, whatever the situation might be. And, even in busy New York airspace, you can sometimes change altitudes or come up with creative ways to still make it happen. It doesn't mean it's going to happen every time. I'm known to be very persistent with ATC in making those kind of requests.
Doug?
I don't know, Tom, you might not have been, and Kevin weren't with us, but we did a scenario three or four recordings back. John Krug had a scenario departing out of Westchester County and coming down through actually a bunch of convective weather. And there was a great discussion about the issues getting through New York, taking off out of Lincoln Park. You're underneath the Bravo. There are arrivals into Newark. There are arrivals into Teterboro. I mean, it's a disaster. If you're willing to go back north and go up towards Delancey, there are ways of doing it. You certainly could negotiate it. It sounds like this, in this situation, there are just times dealing with New York, because the ability of the controllers to hand off to next sectors, to different TRACONs, et cetera, it can be really, really, really difficult in that New York metro area.
Kevin?
Just to kind of build on, I guess it was probably more what Tom was saying. I think of the weather deviations and the way to approach that with ATC, not all that different from if I'm asking for a shortcut through Bravo airspace. Say that as a controller, there's been plenty of times where I'll have a pilot check onto my frequency and I see them going the long way around Bravo. And I'm like, you want a Bravo clearance? Oh, the last guy told us we couldn't get one. Said, well, you're not talking to them anymore. Clear through Bravo airspace and get them on their way. So to that end, I would say that same thing for weather deviations. The moment you check on with a new controller, restate your request for whatever it is that you're looking for a deviation or a different routing or whatever you need to do to safely get around the weather, because the whatever one controller had going on in their sector, maybe the next controller has less traffic going on. They've got more mental bandwidth to deal with whatever your request is, or maybe you're going to cross some line on a map that the next controller could easily give you what it is you're asking for when the last controller couldn't. So not even just facility to facility, but just every time you get a frequency change, if you've got something that you need dealt with, like this weather deviation, absolutely make that request with every single controller you check in with. And then if you're with the same controller for a long time, bug them again if they're not getting it. And you've been, I'm not saying immediately after they say no, you don't go back. How about now? I'm not saying do that, but maybe 30 miles down the road, if you're still with them, ask again and see if maybe there's something that has changed in the interim and you can get what it is that you need.
I know that some pilots will file a destination that's not where they really want to go that gets them going in the right direction, right? And then request a deviation. I'm curious what controllers think of that, because you must see through that plan. You know what's up there.
It really depends on the situation. That's highly situational, and how that might go is going to be very dependent on whose airspace you're flying in and how all that comes together. So there's not a one-size-fits-all answer there.
Sure. Okay, let's get into the weather. I think there's an interesting thing happening here where when you look at that SKU-T diagram, you could very easily come to exactly the wrong conclusion. You look at it and you see that the winds are 50 knots at about 4,000 feet, and they're a lot calmer a few thousand feet above that. And I think someone without the weather expertise could very seemingly logically come to the conclusion that's exactly opposite to Scott's, that 4,000 feet is not the place that you want to be. Scott, how can a pilot be confident in picking 4,000 feet here?
Ryan, I think in this particular case, I had the best piece of information that any pilot could have, and that was my own pilot report. And that is, as soon as we dropped below 4,000 feet, I mean, it smoothed out glassy smooth to the point where you were thinking, you know, the twilight zone, something weird just happened. And, you know, for me, you know, it's like I'm the kind of person that I have a attention deficit disorder, and that is, when the air conditioning kicks on anywhere nearby, I'm looking around, you know, noticing those things. So to me, that was a huge element of what was going on in the atmosphere. But I hadn't pre-flighted that element per se. So, you know, as soon as that hit, and as soon as I knew I was in that smooth air, my first reaction was, I'm going to get on the ground, I'm going to go to the computer, pull up a SKU-T diagram, I'm going to see what's going on. That was my first reaction to this, and confirm that truly we had this surface-based temperature inversion from 4,000 feet all the way down. And then the fact that it matched up really well with what I saw in the air made it a real easy decision. Now, in the case of launching, not having that piece of information, that may have been a little bit more challenging per se, but the fact that I had that eyewitness account, my own, and I could explain it meteorologically and scientifically, made it an easy decision just to, you know, even though it was raining heavy, to go ahead and launch again at 4,000 feet headed southbound.
So your own PIREP was good confirmation for you. But if that first flight hadn't happened and you're sitting in the ground in Richmond looking at this weather picture, do you still have a lot of confidence to launch there and head down at 4,000 feet even without your own personal PIREP?
Yeah, so if this would have been originally a flight out of Richmond headed southbound, you know, I would have had a little bit more hesitation, but ultimately, you know, again, reasonably, I would look at any other pilot reports, and I might even, you know, question pilots that are coming into that, you know, so I would basically call air traffic control and say, by the way, have you had any recent pilot reports in the area for any turbulence below 4,000 feet in this direction to kind of confirm that? So if there were pilot reports, I went on the Aviation Weather Center's website and looked, and there was smooth air, or I got a pilot report from air traffic control, I might, I think I would feel pretty confident looking at the SKU-T to stay below 4,000 feet, but I would not have filed anything higher.
Bruce.
just to follow up on what Scott just said is, at some point in your discussion, you said you know you'd have smooth air. And that's my immediate question was, well, how far out do you know you're going to have smooth air? You had this encounter on your way down, but now you're going to continue the flight. And more to the point, how does a more average pilot like me, who doesn't have a meteorologist's training, how confident can I be that, okay, I could launch again at 4,000. I knew I had smooth air when I came in, but I'm going south based on this situation. Am I going to be back in that kind of weather that I just, you know, descended through?
It's situational, meaning that in this particular case, we were in the center of this upper level trough, essentially. So that area, that protective area, if you will, was pretty large. I looked at a couple of SKU-T diagrams a little bit further south just to verify that inversion still existed. And by the time you get around 100 miles south of there, you were starting to get into clouds that were starting to break up and become clear. It wasn't until 150 miles south that we were definitely in clear air. In fact, as we were flying south out of the system after the flight, we got that about 150 miles south. We start getting bumps again. Well, that was because we were in clear air in thermal turbulence, and so we climbed to 6,000 and got back into the smooth air. So it, you know, it depends. It's situational. You would have to examine the entire area and know exactly what the impacts were. In other situations, you may find that may not be the case. But in this particular situation, I was very confident that we would not have any issues, further south.
Tom.
Yeah, so let's say you get that routing, you're headed south at 4,000 feet, all is good, and you're in your Speedy Cirrus, and ahead of you is some guy in a slower airplane, and ATC says, Cirrus, we need you to climb to 6,000 for traffic. What do you do?
Unable. Now, we thought about those kind of things as we were departing and wondering if we would get into it, but the other aspect of this is I knew that turbulence was not due to convection. So it wasn't like I was going to be turned upside down and, having, in this case for Cirrus, having the composite being bent up. That wasn't the concern there. My original concern for getting on the ground was that we stumbled into maybe embedded convection. In this particular case, I was okay with departing because I knew at this point I wasn't in any kind of thunderstorm situation. The reason for all that turbulence was due to this wind shear that was aloft, and that was due to the primary weather system that was occurring and not due to a convective scenario. So if I had to go to 5,000 or 6 for a short period of time to go around traffic, I would have had to endure again some severe turbulence, severe chop, but it wouldn't have been dangerous per se.
Wally.
I just want to back up to earlier in the flight when they made the decision to land in Richmond. I think that's so hard for us to do as pilots because we're sort of saying, gee, I planned this thing and it's not going as I planned, but it's such a great decision to do that. By landing, first of all, they got a break from that severe turbulence. They learned something about what's going on at 4,000 feet, which made the difference for the whole flight. And number three, they got on the ground. They had additional information. They had time to analyze the rest of that flight and proceed safely. And it just, that one decision made the flight successful. And I think it's just so great.
Kevin and then Scott.
Just a question about the part of the flight prior to landing short, experienced some continuous severe turbulence. You guys didn't have any kind of concerns about the structural integrity of the airplane after landing and continuing on with the flight?
No, in this case, we didn't. I mean, it was, it was severe chop to the point where it was, to be honest, I was less concerned about the severe chop than I was about the deafening rain that was occurring at the time. I mean, it's hard to focus and concentrate when you literally have to turn the sound of the radios up. And oh, by the way, just grabbing the knob to turn the sound up was almost very difficult. But I didn't have any concern that there was any structural issues. Again, it was more like a washboard kind of choppiness. So in that case, it wasn't like we were being bounced up and then back down again. It was just a constant, continuous, severe chop. So there was no concern associated with that.
I have to ask those of you that are not meteorologists here, what would you have done here without a Scott on board with you? Wally.
I think I would have, planned the flight westbound out of Richmond. After that, that was my first choice as I read through the scenario before I read your analysis, Scott. And having read it, certainly I would now select the choice you selected.
Yeah, I'm staying on the ground.
Tom.
Yeah, I'm with Wally because I know that part of the world pretty well, flying up and down the coast all the time. And I probably would have, that would have been my choice too. Get west, get out of there. You're right. I think it was Scott made the point of toward, you know, the mountains over there. But I think, you know, heading that direction, maybe I wouldn't have gone all the way to Roanoke. Maybe I would have tried to make the turn a little bit sooner than that. But that would have been my suggestion too. I now, after seeing your analysis, you know, great idea. Feel more comfortable just heading due south though.
Yeah, Scott, did you have something?
The other hazard here that we generally don't talk about is the fact that, you know, I had to make an instrument approach in as part of that diversion. Again, I still think that was the right choice. But as we were doing this approach, I could also start to gain information that we had this really strong wind in our face. And that's also a symptom of this non-convective low-level wind shear. And as we were approaching the runway, the visibility wasn't great, but when we were looking down at the runway numbers, we couldn't see them. And the reason why was there was so much water on the runway. So ultimately here I'm thinking, okay, we've broken through, we see the runway, but we're gonna end up hydroplaning off the runway just because of that. And so we taxied into the FBO, a little interesting part of the story here, and we get out, and it's raining, you know, cats and dogs, and the FBO guy comes out with a red carpet. No umbrella, the red carpet, and puts it out there so we could literally slop on this red carpet to go back inside. But I was glad to be on the ground at that point and headed in.
The low-level non-convective wind shear, I know, is something that I've heard you talk about, Scott, that a lot of pilots will cancel a flight because they see that in the TAF and they think that means it's going to be really bumpy. But in fact, it's not. And this is a good example. Although it's not in the TAF here, it certainly could be, right?
Yeah, it was kind of strange that they didn't put it in a TAF. There are certain criteria that forecasters at the local weather forecast offices have to meet before they put it in here. Some just you know, it's not there for whatever reason. But non-convective low-level wind shear in of itself is not, and I'll repeat that, not a forecast for turbulence. Now, one of the things that can happen, especially if you get like a heavy rain shower kind of thing going on in the convective wind shear amount is up there in the 50, 60, 70 knot range, that can actually translate to a localized microburst in some cases. But in this case, the rain had been steady and heavy, not necessarily very showery per se. So I wasn't worried about that. In fact, the TAF had light rain as the forecast. And that's actually, again, another indication that I wasn't going to be in a situation where that strong 50 knot wind or so would be translated straight down to the ground during our approach. But in of itself, non-convective low-level wind shear happens so frequently, sometimes they don't forecast it because it happens in the overnight hours with a nocturnal temperature inversion, and you'll see it a lot. And if you don't notice it on your ground speed, it's so glassy smooth, you wouldn't even know it exists.
So something to look for then would be low-level wind shear plus showers might be something that makes it hazardous then, is that right?
Yeah, so in this particular case, normally you think, well, it's non-convective, so how can it be, you know, you just said, you know, showers and convection are, you know, go hand in hand. So ultimately, it can happen, both can happen at the same time. And so if you see like heavy rain showers or rain showers in concert with the non-convective low-level of wind shear, especially as that wind shear number, the wind speed number goes up, that's real important. And so non-convective low-level wind shear is essentially telling you that the winds are rapidly increasing with height. Doesn't really say anything about the direction per se. In this case, the direction really didn't change in that 4,000 feet. So that's a good point. If you want to see kind of where you should avoid this, it's in that situation where you have showery precip and this phenomenon occurring at the same time.
Gotcha. Kevin, do you want to ask the question about the SKU-T?
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a two-part thing. A little bit for Scott. He mentioned that landing short took some time to look at the SKU-Ts to verify what was going on and have a better plan for continuing on. What kind of time and effort did that take to do that? And then kind of a question really for everybody is, how many of the people on here are spending time looking at SKU-T log P diagrams for the route of flight when you're doing your normal cross-country flight planning when you're going on any old trip anywhere?
Yeah, so I think in this particular case, in all cases, it took literally 2 minutes to see this. I mean, literally, I went to the computer at the FBO at the time. No, there's no line to wait. due to the weather that was in the area. So I literally sat down within 2 minutes, brought up the Richmond SKU-T diagram, looked at a couple of other locations. Literally within 2 minutes, I could see exactly what we needed, went back to the other pilot and said, here's the issue. Let's get on board and file for 4,000 and go southbound. And he gave me a thumbs up, and that's what we did. Now, when I started teaching about 20 years ago, I spent a fair amount of time looking at the SKU-T diagram and wondering why that, you know, pilots are not trained to use this. It was just unusual to see that. Now, I know if you do a lot of soaring, a SKU-T diagram is really important, but for the pilot that's not doing that, the SKU-T diagram may be very, not ever taught to you. But I think, you know, if you can unlock its secrets, it's got a lot of good, important information that every pilot can use. And sometimes it can be, you know, the factor that makes your decision. But again, it's a point observation or forecast, so you can't use it to tell the big picture. But it can paint a lot of details in that you don't get from that big picture.
I certainly don't profess to have anywhere near the knowledge of Scott. In fact, I don't have any of the knowledge that Scott does. I did go to, I will say, I went to take a 2-day course specifically on the SKU-T. At the end of day one, my head was just ready to explode. I'd had all I could take. Scott, I'll have to come back and take that course probably 3 more times before I get it all. I certainly couldn't use it to the level that Scott has used it in this particular situation. But I certainly did learn in the course that I took with him how to use it to see where freezing levels are, to see where the tops are, to see where bases are, to see whether there's an inversion or not. I have just an inkling of knowledge about it. And yet I do use it on virtually every flight.
There's an analogy here that occurs to me to a VFR pilot who wants to learn some of the basics of IFR procedures, maybe learn how to fly ODPs to get out of an airport at night or something like that. And, you know, you might say someone like that has to be careful because they're learning maybe just enough to be dangerous, right? There's some nuances that they could overlook by learning a little bit of IFR procedure, but not a lot. And I think that might apply a little bit here where, you know, knowing the SKU-T diagram, but not the theory behind it, could get you into trouble here. You might make exactly the wrong decision. And I know, Scott, you've talked about before how just learning by flying in weather and by trial and error is not a good way to learn weather, really. You've got to actually go and learn some weather theory. And I think that's probably where it's at here, is learn as much weather theory as you can. Maybe have access to an expert or a mentor that you can ask these questions. And don't try to do it by trial and error, given what the consequences of error can be in these situations.